This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Earth Matters. I'm Mira Sivasuthi. You love our lush rainforest, but when was the last time you walked in a mangrove forest? We may not enjoy the warm, humid mangrove forest and its relentless mosquitoes, but these forests protect our coasts and serve as nursery ground for much of our seafood. Sadly, we're fast losing these mangrove forests to commercial activities. Dr. Dan Frius, Assistant Professor in the Department of Geography at the National University of Singapore, studies mangrove ecosystems at the Regional Conference for the Society for Conservation Biology held in Malacca in August 2014. Lau Yahua spoke to Dan about the status and functions of mangrove forests in Southeast Asia.
Can you give us an idea of the extent or diversity of coastal ecosystems that we have here in Southeast Asia?
So Southeast Asia is really a hotspot for all coastal ecosystems. Whether it's a coral reef, whether it's a mangrove, whether it's a seagrass, we have the most biodiverse in terms of this number of species, but we also have the most area. So Indonesia, for example, has about 20% of the world's mangrove, just in Indonesia. So it's a huge resource, and we're really lucky to have it, and it's providing so many services to different people throughout the region.
You describe it as like a great resource. What sort of functions or ecosystem services are you talking about?
Well, I could be talking for half an hour on how many there are. There's such a range of them. We'll take the most obvious ones that you can visibly see, so fish, for example. Most commercially important fish species have at least part of their life cycle in the mangrove or in the seagrass. Even the ones that live quite far offshore, maybe they come into the mangrove to spawn, and it's a nursery ground where they're protected from predators. The fish can swim within the roots of the tree, protect themselves from bigger predators, until they grow larger enough to then go back into the open sea. So a lot of the fish and shellfish that we consume, you know, the mangrove is partly responsible for that. So that's kind of an immediate, visible service. Then there are construction materials, other provisioning services, other materials that can be got from the mangrove. Then there are these kind of more invisible services that we don't really appreciate every day, and we can't really value them very well, but they're still really important. So coastal protection during a storm or during a high tide event, mangroves and seagrasses and reefs may play some role in kind of reducing the size of the waves that maybe hit the shoreline. So there's a kind of a coastal protection function. So many, I don't know which ones to pick.
In this conference, I've heard a lot about carbon storage, and they talk about organic matter in mangrove ecosystems. Can you tell us more about that?
So carbon is the next big thing in coastal ecosystem research and also in conservation. So a mangrove is a tree. That tree is made of carbon. In the soil is a lot of carbon from the leaves that fall into the mangrove, and then because it's a very wet tidal environment, there's not a lot of oxygen, so that carbon in the leaves and the branches doesn't break down. It forms kind of like a peat. So it's, you know, a very high percentage of carbon, and that carbon is building up over thousands and thousands of years. So you have a huge amount of carbon in the soil and some carbon in the vegetation as well. And this is important when we are talking about climate change. We have a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that's increasing every year, potentially due to anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. So maybe mangroves, as well as other vegetated ecosystems, may be able to lock up some of that carbon from the atmosphere and lock it in the tree, lock it in the soil, and be kind of one way of mitigating against climate change.
Mm. And how do the carbon storage capacity of mangroves compare to, say, a tropical forest?
So there's been a huge amount of emphasis on protecting tropical terrestrial forests for their carbon. And they do have a lot of carbon, but mangroves can have 2, 3, 4 times as much carbon. And it's not really in the vegetation because the trees are, you know, similar size. It's all in the soil. It's this thousands of years of accumulation and that carbon not being broken down because it's too wet and there's not enough oxygen. It's the same reason why peat swamps, freshwater peat swamps, also have a huge amount of carbon locked up in their soil. So peat swamps, mangroves, they both have much more carbon than an equivalent dry terrestrial system because it's all locked up in the soil.
And would the carbon that's locked up in peat swamps or in mangroves be more stable, in a more inert state compared to those in the tropical forest?
Actually, I would say it may be more unstable. It's stable in its present form, but we're on the coast, and the coast is a very dynamic place. You've got tides and wind and waves and all these kind of processes that shape the mangrove. So it's doesn't take a huge change in some of these processes for a mangrove to be, instead of being a sink for carbon and soaking up carbon, it becomes a really important source of carbon if it starts breaking down and releasing all of this carbon that's been locked up for thousands of years.
Is that happening now? Are there any threats to the mangrove ecosystems that may potentially release all this carbon?
Oh, there's a huge number of threats. When I said at the beginning that Southeast Asia has the most biodiverse and the most area of these coastal ecosystems, conversely, we're also the region of the world where some of these coastal ecosystems are under the most amount of threat from natural processes such as, you know, storms and typhoons and tsunami and these kind of short-term but very high magnitude natural events. But then there's all the anthropogenic and human influences on a coastal ecosystem as well. So land reclamation, urban development. A big issue in Southeast Asia has been conversion of mangroves to shrimp ponds. So I said that mangroves provide good shelter for fish and shellfish. And so we've been using mangroves by deforesting them and using that space for aquaculture. More recently, oil palm may be a threat to coastal ecosystems as we drain mangroves to plant oil palm. And that's just the more direct short-term impacts. Then you've got issues such as sea level rise and you know, these kind of longer-term threats that we maybe don't know as much about and we can't control as easily as land reclamation, for example.
Once you clear the mangroves or, you know, we convert it to agriculture or say we convert it into aquaculture, if you want to reverse that process, is it easy or is it very difficult for the mangroves to regenerate?
It should be easy for mangroves to regenerate. Some mangrove species at least can grow in many different types of environment. And they're very resistant to all of these physical processes, the tide coming in every day, the waves. So in theory, it should be, you know, it's not rocket science to grow mangroves. You know, mangroves are growing naturally all over our region, so they must be doing something right. Despite how it should be easy, we're still not, our success at restoring and recreating mangroves by man is actually quite low compared to natural recruitment and increase in mangrove.
Then it sounds like we shouldn't really be destroying them or, you know, converting them into other things in the first place. But all the, you know, all the trends that you mentioned just now, most of them were, you know, most of them are commercial activities that would generate income for, you know, the local community, the nation. So how would we be able to encourage the institutions, the establishment, to conserve coastal ecosystems like mangroves?
This is a really new area that we're thinking about for mangroves now. So how do you convince somebody that it's worth conserving a mangrove and not over the long term, where you may get lots of long-term benefits from those ecosystem services I told you about? How do you convince somebody that that's worth more than, you know, changing it, cutting it down for agriculture and getting a much more immediate return by, you know, selling the fish? And this is a really big issue, is how we convince people that mangroves are good for all those ecosystem services I told you about. Because if you want to conserve mangrove instead of cutting it down for aquaculture, for example, then you're foregoing a certain amount of income. There's an opportunity cost, you know, associated with not fishing or not using it for aquaculture. So one way is to do a scheme called Payments for Ecosystem Services. So you pay somebody, for example, not to cut down the mangrove, and maybe you gave them carbon credits. So you can offset your carbon emissions when you fly on a number of airlines, and maybe we can use that money to pay to somebody who otherwise would cut that down for aquaculture.
That was Dr. Dan Frears, Assistant Professor at the National University of Singapore, speaking to Lau Yeo Hua. Up next, Dan will tell us how paying for ecosystem services may account for the real cost of destroying mangrove forests for development on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Mira Sivasodi. Earlier, Dr. Dan Frears from the National University of Singapore explained the services that mangrove forests give us and that we may better conserve mangrove forests if we charge for these services. Lau Yeo Hua continues the conversation.
So you mentioned paying for ecosystem services. What would the success of such a scheme depend on?
Yeah. Lots of different things. They're not easy to do. We've been doing this payments for ecosystem services now for a couple of decades, and so we're figuring out what makes a good scheme and what doesn't make a good scheme. So yeah, we've been doing this in New York, for example, where New York City has been paying farmers upstate to reduce their fertilizer input so it reduces the water pollution. So that's a very famous example, and that's been working quite well. But there are a number of issues related especially to payments for ecosystem services schemes in the tropics. There's a major push now to try and use carbon credits to conserve terrestrial and coastal habitats. And there's a huge number of issues. First of all, you need to be able to quantify the ecosystem service. Some are quite easy to quantify. Fish. You can quantify fish by the size of the catch, the volume, the amount of income that's created by fisheries. That's quite an easy one to quantify. How do you quantify the amount of carbon? That gets a little bit more difficult. How do you quantify the coastal protection value of a coastal habitat? How do you value the cultural aspects of a coastal habitat? You can quantify the recreational value or the tourism value in terms of the number of dollars that are brought in by having a wetland there, maybe for ecotourism, but what about spiritual value? These are all important values in ecosystem services and benefits of coastal ecosystems, but some are easier to value than others. So that's the first major limitation to paying somebody for ecosystem services. Then there are all sorts of issues that we've heard about at this conference in terms of social equity. So carbon credits may be given to wealthy participants in a scheme, and so the income gap increases because the wealthy get wealthier, and the poor get poorer. That's something that's been discussed here. There's all sorts of governance issues. Who owns the land? Where does the money? If you sell a carbon credit, does that money go to a commercial company? Does it go to the government? Does it go to a local community? If you have an indigenous community, it gets more complicated as well, because you need to own the land maybe in order to receive benefits. So there's all sorts of physical and ecological issues around quantifying the service, but there's all these whole host of social issues around who benefits as well.
You mentioned that coastal ecosystems are very dynamic, and so even if we can quantify a value now, I can still imagine that value may very likely change, you know, across time and even across spatial scales. Is this a concern?
Yeah, and so say you have a mangrove, and I'm going to pay you a certain amount of money every year for the next 20 years, and then you're going to give me a return on my investment, and I will make some amount of profit, and you will keep some money. Now, I'm only going to invest in that if you can be sure that every year you're going to produce that ecosystem service at a level that you set now, and I'm going to give you money for that service. But what if, for some reason, the ecosystem service reduces, especially if that's something out of your control? So that's what a lot of my research is looking at, is how do natural and human processes, how do they affect the amount of ecosystem service you have, so that maybe we can predict how much we will have in the future. So, and I said at the start that coastal ecosystems are really dynamic, and that it can very quickly go from being a sink of carbon, for example, to a source of carbon. But I want to pay you to keep it as a sink. But you have to maybe control all of the processes that might convert it into a source of carbon.
Can you then describe some of the possible complicating factors that might cause a scheme to not work, perhaps due to some stress factors that players in the scheme cannot control.
So you have a mangrove, right? And it's near a harbour or a port. Because there's going to be ship activity outside your mangrove, and those ships are going to cause ship wake. And that ship wake may erode your mangrove. And when your mangrove erodes and falls apart, that releases carbon. Now, if you have a protected area boundary around your mangrove to try and protect that carbon, it doesn't control the shipping, for example. So that's a stress that's happening outside your site, and I'm only paying for that site. I'm not paying for things outside the site if I'm investing in a scheme. But those activities outside are having an impact on the ecosystem services in the patch that I'm paying you money for. So that's a very kind of small scale issue. So yeah, a ship just outside your mangrove. But there are mangroves and other habitats are affected by so many other things. They're affected by pest infestation. So you might get some insects that destroy the mangrove. And again, those insects came from outside, right? There may be pollution from a river. These are terrestrial pollution from farming, that the river goes into the coastal zone and causes pollution that may have an impact on your mangrove. Sea level rise. You know, these are really large-scale issues that if you are a manager of a site, you can't control it. But if I'm going to give you money, I want you to try and control it because I want you to have a stable ecosystem so that I don't lose money on my investment.
It sounds like the future for this scheme, paying for ecosystem services, is not too bright. But can we manage this scheme in different ways, or can we change our mentality towards it to make it work?
I think we can make it work, and we have examples now where it is starting to work. So we have to be smart about how we implement a payments for ecosystem services scheme, especially in these dynamic coastal environments. So what some schemes do is they say that your mangrove is worth 10,000 carbon credits. Maybe you only sell 8,000 of them and you keep 2,000 of these credits in reserve. So that maybe if you lose some of your carbon, you still have this credit buffer, so you can still repay me. That's one way that quite a few schemes do. You may be able to provide ecosystem service insurance so that I'm insured against any loss of my investment. Then there are other things that we can do to try and reduce these external stresses on your site. So we can do large-scale coastal management and planning, so that if we think that there's an activity along the coast, such as a new development or a new reclamation that may impact the ecosystem credits in your mangrove site, maybe we can do environmental impact assessment to try and construct that in a way where we reduce the impact on our natural coastal habitats. So there's all sorts of different tools that we can use, and we just have to be smart about how we use them.
Before we end, what message would you like to leave us with on conservation of mangrove or coastal ecosystems here in Southeast Asia and the way moving forward?
The message I want to give is that, you know, we underappreciate coastal ecosystems so much. They don't have the big charismatic animals. We don't get elephants in mangroves. We don't get the pandas in mangroves. Most people don't like to visit mangroves. They're hot and smelly and full of mosquitoes, which I work in mangroves. I guess I love those things about it. So they don't have these kind of immediate charismatic parts about them, but they're so fundamental to everybody who lives in this region. If you eat fish, you rely on the mangrove. So there's all of these kind of indirect, invisible linkages. And I guess my message is, let's appreciate them more. Go visit them. You know, let's try and really contribute to their conservation. They're kind of the unsung heroes of ecosystems in our region. And we really need to value them more and really value the benefits and conserve them so that we can get the benefits, but also future generations can also receive the same benefits that we're receiving from mangroves and seagrasses and corals at the moment.
That was Dr. Dan Frias speaking to Lau Yahua at the Regional Conference for the Society for Conservation Biology held in Malacca in August 2014. You've been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.